Rolling.
This is the FedSoc Films Podcast,
where we continue the conversation sparked on film.
You want to know what freedom tastes like? It tastes like this beer.
Take one.
This is, in fact, the classic solution in search of a problem.
Action.
That cannot help but be controversial.
Cut.
With expert discussion and analysis.
With the greatest legal minds on the topic today. The FedSoc Films Podcast.
It's a wrap.
Welcome to the FedSoc Films Podcast. I'm Samantha Schroeder, Deputy Director of FedSoc Films. This episode is all about our film, The Philosophers Behind the Founders. What radical idea did John Locke propose in his two treatises of government that inspired the founding of America? Today, we have two professors from the film, Paul Carice and Michael Zugert, to answer that question and more. We're locked, stocked, and ready to barrel forward. Welcome to the show, and thanks for being on with us.
Thanks, Samantha. Good to see you again.
Thank you, Samantha.
I'll start by asking, who was John Locke, and why did the American Founding Fathers care about him?
I'll try my hand at that one. John Locke was a British philosopher of mostly the 17th century. He died 1704, right into the beginning of the 18th century. He was a very wide-ranging philosopher in his interests, with works in the area of religion, politics, epistemology, and so on. Extremely influential and famous philosopher for his time. Most importantly, for the Americans, he was a political philosopher who developed a theory, among other things, of a right of revolution to which they appealed when they made the American Revolution.
And as Michael mentioned, one of Locke's writings on the idea of religious toleration, about what the relationship should be between the state, the government, the politics on the one hand, and religious liberty of individuals on the other, was also very influential for the Constitution's ideas of no religious test for office, and then the First Amendment and Bill of Rights.
So why was John Locke so influential at the time of the American Revolution?
To understand that, that's a bit of a complicated question, and it has to do with the nature of the conflict that led to the American Revolution. On the one hand, the Americans had a notion that they were basically a self-governing society. That is, that they were to be governed largely by their own assemblies, by their own legislatures, together with the king. That is, they understood themselves to be connected with England through the king, but not through Parliament. That is, they denied the authority of Parliament. Whereas the British understood the relationship quite differently. The British understood that the colonies were subject to the authority of Parliament, as they put it in a law that they passed in 1765, that the colonies were subject in all cases whatsoever to the authority of Parliament. So these are quite different theories of authority. The Americans believing that they had that Parliament had no authority over them, and Parliament believing that it had authority in all cases whatsoever. Now, Locke turned out to be important because his theory of government persuaded the Americans that their preferred version of this constitution, if you will, was the correct one. They understood Locke's philosophy to underwrite the notion of legitimate authority to be the one that was there, the one that they preferred.
In Locke's second treatise, in particular, of the two treatises of government, the ideas of a social contract that each individual has rights by nature. has rights by nature to life, liberty, property, means that people cannot be legitimately ruled unless they have consented to a form of government and then continually consent to those forms as legitimately protecting their rights. This is the social contract idea. So for the Americans, this was, and Locke is the kind of philosopher who writes in search of universal truths. So Locke, we'll talk about the contrast with Montesquieu. Locke emphasizes clear, very direct universal statements about what is legitimate and what is not legitimate. So the Americans take these ideas to say we can't be ruled, for example, on the crucial question of taxation. We can't be ruled by these representatives in parliament for whom we never voted and we don't know. We accept the legitimacy of the king, but we have our own elected or selected representatives here. And that argument coming from Locke was practically politically useful in crisis.
Yeah, and therefore made Locke very attractive to the Americans, partly because he supported their theory. Also, I should say one of the reasons why Locke had an attraction in America was just Locke had an attraction all over the world at this time. He was probably the leading philosopher of the time. That is, if you were to look around and say, who are the important philosophers today, Locke's name would be at the top of the list, or at least very near the top of the list. Authors in a Cambridge Companion to Locke said, John Locke is the most influential philosopher of modern times. Now, that, of course, is a debatable claim, but nonetheless, there's some evidence that Locke was indeed, at least in the 18th century, does indeed match that description. I would say, well, you know, Paul, I would add one point to your to the general contrast between Locke and Montesquieu that we've talked about and we'll talk about some more, that that the Americans saw Locke's theory and Locke saw his own theory as not just abstract, but as a theory that fit the experience of the peoples that they were talking to. So the British themselves had, he attempted self-consciously to develop a theory that was indeed connected to, if not identical, to what the British had been used to practicing, that is, the parliament, at least under certain interpretations of the arrangements, the parliament had indeed the authority to tax and legislate. And likewise, the Americans, they had been used to living under an arrangement where the British had largely left them alone to govern themselves and tax themselves as they claimed was their right. And it was only after the French and Indian War ended in 1763 that the British decided they needed to recoup some of the money they had spent in that war and wanted to tax the Americans. And so it was only at that point that the conflict between these two different theories of authority really came into play. But when the Americans appealed to Locke, they were appealing to a Locke who suited very much their own past history and their own past practices. It was one of the things about the American Revolution is that the Americans adopted Locke in this more wholehearted way than the British had done. And that was especially true by the later part of the 18th century when the British had kind of drifted away from a more Lockean understanding to what degree they had it earlier. So partly the disagreement between the Americans and the British had to do with the role of Locke in the public political culture of those two countries.
These striking claims in the Second Treatise about the rights of individuals as the sole legitimate base of government. And then just talk for a moment about the later argument in the Second Treatise, in a way implicit in the early statements about rights and legitimate government, the later argument about a right of revolution per se. And this is very clearly influential on the opening paragraphs of the Declaration of Independence.
So the American theory, or the Lockean theory, I should say, which the Americans take over and paraphrase in the Declaration of Independence, goes something like this. Human beings are by nature, that is originally, by nature, not subject to political authority. Nobody has been appointed by God or by nature or any other source with authority over other human beings. And Locke calls this situation a state of nature. And it's interesting, he doesn't think of this state of nature as a kind of early historical situation of human beings, but he says every human being is in this situation at the start. That is to say, no human being is naturally subject to the authority of some ruler or other. So he also says human beings in this state of nature or by nature have these rights, rights to life, right to liberty, right to property, to which Jefferson adds in a Lockean vein, a right to the pursuit of happiness as well. If there is no political authority to start with, does that mean that there's no political authority at all? No, Locke is not an anarchist in this sense. He's not attempting to dissolve political authority. He's asking the question, what is it that justifies political authority? That's really Locke's main question, and really the question that gets what we might think of as the liberal political tradition off the ground. What justifies political authority, if anything? And his answer is going to be consent of the governed, and he's going to show why the governed, why people will set up government and will consent to it, because life without government turns out to be problematical. And he uses his account or his narrative about the state of nature as a way of trying to show what it is about human beings will lead to a conflict without government, to which government is the solution. So according to this story, human beings set up governments in order to achieve certain ends. And as Jefferson put it, those ends are in order to secure these rights. That is, in order to secure the rights that they have prior to the establishment of government, rights to life, rights to liberty, rights to property, rights to the pursuit of happiness. Now, if government does not succeed in establishing and protecting those rights, if government fails either because it's incompetent, which is possible, or because it has ill will, because it's seeking to favor the rulers rather than the ruled, you know, whatever the set of reasons why governments might fail at their duties, nonetheless, the people have a right, when governments fail, to, again, as Jefferson puts it, alter or abolish that government. That's the Lockean formulation.
So that was actually a perfect transitional point for me to ask a very pointed question. What radical political or philosophical idea did Locke propose?
I'll take a stab at how Locke's philosophy has been controversial in recent decades in academic, public intellectual debate in the United States, is that Locke is radical in claiming, as Michael was just describing, that individuals by nature are not naturally social, are not naturally in political community, and they must form a completely artificial political community. And the criticism is from social, moral, intellectual conservatives that this is a concept of human beings and of politics that can't ever really form a genuine community, a genuine political community, a sustainable political community. There's too much focus on the concept of the individual as an atom separate from other atoms, too much focus on the rights and interests and claims of the individual. And so you have a simulacra of a political community, you know, you have laws and a government, but eventually the focus on individual rights, interest claims, is just so overbearing that you get social disintegration. It could work for a time, but it has within itself the seeds, a Lockean conception has the seeds of its own self-disintegration. So, Michael, what do you think of that view, that Locke's not stuff radical, he's too radical for his own good?
I think it's quite mistaken. I think that's quite mistaken. One reason being, almost from the beginning of what you said, Locke is not claiming that human beings live asocially. There's nothing about asociality in Locke. He's only claiming that they do not live under political authority from the beginning. He knows just as much as anybody knows that we're born into families and that we live socially. For example, we couldn't be human without being speaking animals, and we couldn't speak without society. So Locke has no such claim that human beings live without society. What he's claiming is that there's no claim of authority that exists by nature. And so the authority is constructed by the human beings. The point of the construction, though, is to guarantee that political authority is directed toward the good of the ruled, and not the claims or good of the rulers. And that's a radical claim in some ways. One of the somewhat radical claims that follows from that is that human beings shouldn't be subject to authorities in which they have no hand in the selection. So we should be all governed by legislatures which we have had a voice in selecting. And so we might say the democratic impetus of modern life is given a push by Locke in his philosophy. Maybe he's the founder of it. Likewise, this right of revolution, it's not as though there was no revolution accepted in previous thought, but Locke, I think, makes the most universal claim that there is such a right, that it does not depend upon any of the ruling class in order to be activated. Therefore, it stands as a kind of, how should we say, a kind of threat, I guess you would say, an ultimate threat, because it's by no means to be appealed to lightly, an ultimate threat to all ruling elites, that there's this legitimate limit to what they can accomplish. And at the extreme end, that's, you know, a fairly strong kind of limit. So I'd say those are among the radical ideas that Locke introduces, and I don't see them as having the dissolving effects that I know you didn't. You're not raising that claim, but that some of the critics of Lockean theory raise.
One of the other dimensions here about Locke and the American founding is that while he is the single most, arguably the single most important influence on thinking about America's situation vis-a-vis the Parliament, the King, in the 1760s, 1770s. The Americans are the Americans, and they are predominantly Protestant Christian. There are other ideas about legitimate politics, not quite Lockean, somewhat distinct. The Scottish Enlightenment view, Montesquieu has something of an influence about laws and constitutions. One person that, an important jurist, William Blackstone, is influenced by both Locke and Montesquieu. So the Americans are confronted with or have access to a rich range of thinking about what to do in this crisis. You know, by the early 1770s, conflict has broken out, there's blood spilled, and as they focus, Locke remains the single most important figure because he's clearly laid out these propositions from legitimate government to revolution. But even if one wanted to argue, well, Locke's philosophy is too individualistic, is too atomistic, it's also the case that even if that were so, the Americans are selecting the elements of Locke's philosophy, the arguments from Locke's philosophy that work for them as a package. So the Declaration of Independence is a somewhat complicated document if we read the whole thing, which most professors don't teach anymore, the whole thing, or most Americans don't read the whole thing. But the whole package in the Declaration of Independence, just to take the last phrase, you know, in defense of this concept of legitimate government, of rights, of revolution, we mutually pledge our lives, our fortunes, our sacred honor. So there are elements beyond Locke's philosophy that the Americans think fit with Locke's philosophy to make the argument they want to make and to explain who they are to the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I absolutely agree with that, Paul. I think that's a good observation. And it's a good reply in a way to the, you know, to the critics of Locke that you were speaking of earlier. I don't think that's an accident. I think Locke's philosophy itself is open to that kind of, how should we say, accretion of other traditions. Among other things, Locke himself appeals in many important ways to Christian traditions. He appeals to the common law tradition. He appeals to English history. So there's a kind of openness in Locke to being used in the way that the Americans used him. But there's no question also that they brought their own history, their own materials to that Lockean philosophy, and created, I like to call it, the American amalgam, that is a political culture which has elements in it which are Lockean in important ways in the decisive political formulations, but in many other ways they add things to Locke. So to take one example, the Americans in the Declaration endorse a form of providentialism, let's say, that goes beyond. Locke does not really appeal to providentialism very much in his philosophy, but that the Americans add it is significant for the formulation of this American amalgam and for the formulation of American political culture, which even though these many years later lives on, at least in some form, with us today. So, yes, I'm very much in agreement with what you have to say there.
One of the things that brings together the Federalist Society and the two of us, Michael, is the view that Americans now take for granted what Locke's philosophy and the American reception of Locke introduces into the definition of America, which is these views of individual liberty, that government exists to serve the governed, not to serve some inherent governing class, that we don't teach this very much anymore in universities, and therefore it doesn't come out in schools. And we live off of and we enjoy a culture of liberty, but we're not understanding it and not doing everything we might do to exercise it and sustain it.
Can we talk a bit about, more specifically, about Locke's influence on the Declaration of Independence?
So one of the bits of testimony to the role of Locke in America and in the American Revolution is the way in which the Declaration of Independence is so closely connected to Locke's philosophy. Somebody or other has made a list of all the places where not merely Locke's general philosophy, but specific words and phrases from Locke's treatises show up in the Declaration of Independence. And that's a pretty strong indication of the role of Locke. Now, Jefferson does say, I had a passage here I was going to share with you all about what Jefferson says here. He does try to share the credit for the Declaration. But here's what he says that's, I think, really interesting. In his later life, Jefferson claimed and was given credit for having written the Declaration, which was an important thing for his own prestige as a politician, and I think he took much pride in it as a human being. And so he was accused, though, by envious others of having just copied the Declaration from Locke. That's one of the things that was charged against him. And in response to those charges, one of those charges, he wrote the following about the Declaration and his authorship. And this was in 1825, the year before he died. So very near his end. This, he says, was the object of the Declaration of Independence, not to find out new principles or new arguments never before thought of, not merely to say things which had never been said before, but to place before mankind the common sense of the subject in terms so plain and firm as to command their assent and to justify ourselves in the independent stand we are compelled to take. Neither aiming at originality of principle or sentiment, nor yet copied from any particular and previous writing, It was intended to be an expression of the American mind, an expression of the American mind. And to give to that expression the proper tone and spirit called for by the occasion. And I have to say, as an editorial comment, I think he succeeds beautifully at that. It's such a wonderful document, and it hits just the right tone.
Yeah, Michael, Jefferson is not my favorite founder, but it is extraordinary to think that Adams and the committee select Jefferson as the drafter, and he drafts it. They, the committee, Franklin, Adams, Livingston, they make a few changes to it.
Very few.
Then the Congress debates it, and there are the reports that, you know, Jefferson's sort of squirming, sitting, you know, there. Yeah. But they really don't make many changes, and none of them really structural, right?
No.
So this argument or testimony 49 years later is fairly accurate. It's not just self-serving, that he assigned himself the task in 1776 of expressing the American mind, at least in that group of Continental Congress delegates.
Yeah.
And the fact that there were so few revisions to it suggests he did. He captured it.
Yep. Let me finish this passage and then make another comment about about what you were saying, Paul. All his authority, Jefferson says, rests on the harmonizing sentiments of the day, whether expressed in conversation, in letters, printed essays, or in the elementary books of public right, as Aristotle, Cicero, Locke, Sidney, etc. That is, Jefferson wants to say there are others who he drew upon and who share some of these views. Nonetheless, I would say the dominant voice is Locke's voice, even if there are things from these others. And the idea that these are the harmonizing sentiments is very visible when we look at documents produced in other states, in other on other occasions by the Americans. The same basic Lockean story, a state of nature, a social contract, a set of natural rights, a right of revolution. These elements occur over and over again in language clearly echoing Lockean language. So if we were to say, Locke's presence in the American Revolution is visible not merely in the Declaration of Independence, but in the American mind, I think we'd be safe in saying that.
And even further, you know, in the 1840s, the Seneca Falls Convention and the Seneca Falls Declaration, this coalition of abolitionists and women's rights advocates, women's suffrage, but generally women's rights advocates, they make this decision under Elizabeth Cady Stanton's influence to use the opening paragraphs of the Declaration of Independence, paraphrase them, adjust them somewhat to say, well, this is the argument for the abolition of slavery, and this is the argument for extending to women the equal citizenship that we are, to which we are entitled by natural right.
Yeah, absolutely. To say nothing of the influence of Locke elsewhere, the French Revolution produced the Declaration of the Rights of Man and Citizen, which also has great Lockean content. The Vietnamese, when they declared independence, they paraphrased the Declaration of Independence. So this is a document that not merely affected the American mind, but other mind, Vietnamese mind as well.
Was John Locke the first political thinker to propose the right to revolution as a natural right?
He's the first to have presented it in as universal terms and not to have involved, how should we say, there were many theories of resistance, there were some theories of no rightful resistance, whatever, that was very common. There were some theories of rightful resistance which depended upon magistrates, that is, people actually in authority to mobilize or to authorize resistance to other parts of the government. But Locke is the one who affirms a right of revolution, which short circuits that, doesn't require any official blessing by any of the authorities, can just appeal to the people.
One of the interesting issues about the phrase in the Declaration or series of sentences that's most obviously indebted to Locke is This phrasing Jefferson uses, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, endowed by the Creator with these inalienable rights. Now it takes, in the American case, and in many other cases, it takes hundreds of years to fully, equally shape the laws so that all human beings do have the protection of government for these rights. And Lincoln is wonderfully eloquent about this in the 1840s and the 1850s. These phrases are not false because we still have slavery or we haven't extended the right of voting or equal citizenship to women. But the crucial point, I think, is that the hold part doesn't mean we're just sort of making it up now. And this is what we believe. It's the authority to which you're appealing is the view that, you know, I'm a human being, you're a human being, how could we deny we're human beings? And all human beings have these rights inherent. So that's the Lockean insight. And this is why Lincoln just persistently keeps going back to the phrases in the Declaration that are the Lockean phrases to say, are you blind? These are human beings. We've got to figure out how to more fully extend and painfully reform and adapt our political community. And it's not because we hold, in some sense, we're making it up on the spot. It's that we have to live up to these principles, which are inherent in every human being, and therefore our whole political community is obliged to hold up to these.
Is America the first country to enact the radical idea of John Locke's right to revolution?
Yes.
Yes.
Just a straight yes.
I don't know if you've covered all of his ideas, but can you touch on which of Locke's ideas made it into the American founding documents?
Almost everything that was central to Lockean political thought made it into American founding documents. There were some elements that Locke emphasized. A very important part of Locke's thinking is his discussions of property. Now, the Americans, I think, for the most part, accepted his doctrine of property, but they don't make a big deal of it in their documents, because the conflict that they had with Britain didn't necessarily require that they do that. Although I'd say their acceptance of the Lockean doctrine had something to do with their firmness, in their view that the British did not have the right to tax them. Because of Locke developed his argument like this: because we have a right to property, a natural right to property, the government does not have a right to just take it from us. If somebody has a right to take something from you, it's not your property. To have property is to have a right not to have somebody take something from you, but to have it, to possess it. So taxation, as Locke understands it, is not a taking by the government, but is a giving by the people, by the owners, to the government in return for the services that government supplies to them. That is, supplies them protection in their life and their liberty and all of those things. And so, therefore, taxation can only be done by an assembly in which the property owners are represented. And so the Americans, in accepting the Lockean theory of property, were confirmed in their idea that the British Parliament, in which they were not represented, could not possibly be the body that had the legitimate authority to tax them. But they don't go into Locke's discussions of property. That is, it's something that's sort of in the background that they accept, but they don't discuss. And there are other aspects of Locke's philosophy that they don't discuss very much. But everything that, at least as I believe at the moment, everything that was really relevant to their situation in Lockean philosophy does indeed find expression in their documents.
The main lines of argument from the second treatise and the main point of the letter on toleration are present from the Declaration to the 1787 Constitution to the Bill of Rights, in the founding period, at least. And we could go beyond to further amendments, but they're all there. The idea of inherent natural rights of individuals, a social contract, legitimate government, the forms and structures of legitimate government. We haven't talked much about that, but Locke does have an argument about a separation of powers. There's a legislative power directly expressing the consent of the governed, and then an executive and complicated relations between those two powers, and then on to a right of revolution. All of that's there from the Declaration to the 1787 Constitution. And then the letter concerning toleration would be an important, crucial influence on part of the Constitution and then on the Bill of Rights. So I would say our conversation here, the Federalist Society and Michael and myself, is talking about Locke and Montesquieu. And while Montesquieu does come to the fore in the 1780s, when the question arises whether the Articles of Confederation, the first constitution, is working out so well as doing what we Americans wanted to do, Montesquieu does come to the fore, Blackstone comes to the fore, but it's not an either-or choice here. It's not as if the Americans read their reliance on Montesquieu and Montesquieu supporting the 1787 Constitution or the Anti-Federalists citing Montesquieu to say, oh no, this 1787 Constitution is not right in this point or that. It's not for the Americans a choice. We're now turning away from Locke. It's that they, you know, as Michael has already noted, the Americans are amalgamators. Jefferson notes this, you know, so there's more than one authority to which they cite. Locke is central in the 1770s, the argument for independence and revolution, but he isn't canceled by the fact that there are elements of Montesquieu's political philosophy, of Blackstone's commentaries on the laws of England, that are more useful in the particular circumstances and for the particular problems and arguments of the 1780s, because Locke influences Montesquieu and Locke even more so influences Blackstone.
What would you say is the enduring influence of John Locke?
I think our commitment to democracy is an enduring influence of Locke. I think our commitment to the idea of rights is an enduring influence of Locke. I think our idea, at least in America, of the legitimacy and desirability of a separation of powers in political structure is an enduring influence of Locke, although others, Montesquieu, especially important as an additional influence on that. I think our ideas of religious toleration, of the relationship between government and religion is an enduring influence of Locke. I think capitalism is part of the enduring influence of Locke. What more? There may be some other things, but those seem among the biggies.
Just to further develop some of those, every time Americans argue with each other about whether a local government, a state government, the federal government is legitimate or right, and every time Americans very openly at a city council meeting or town meeting or about state government or federal government, every time they forthrightly stand up and say, this executive or legislator or whoever, just wrong, right? And to do that without the remotest thought that you face some criminal penalty or some sanction, just the whole concept that the government does not exist to serve the government. The government is selected from, is based on the consent of the governed, and that consent of the governed means that the government serves the governed. And we take that for granted every day. We have this, in this large sense, this right to do this. And the clarity and strength of Locke's formulation of these principles carries on hundreds of years later, even though we don't every day attach Locke's name to it.
Mm-hmm. And one additional point that we haven't mentioned, but I think is really important. the American commitment to the rule of law, I think, owes a good deal to Locke. And also to Montesquieu, I think he's another very important force in that. And indeed, I would say among the most lasting and most important Lockean heritages would be a commitment to the rule of law. Many other things can change in political society, in political structure, in political aims, but the rule of law should remain with us forever.
There's an interesting paradox about the second treatises in this way. So I'm glad you brought that up, Michael, that the focus legitimately on a right of revolution, which is an extraordinary innovation on his part, could make it seem that he's not an advocate of the rule of law or constitutionalism. I think Locke's point is that a certain testiness in the people, right, that a vigilance in the people about their rights, and to constantly be assessing, is the government in fact living up to this social contract? Is the government in fact securing and protecting our rights? Or is the government in some way has it become self-serving? That kind of testiness and the constant threat of a right of revolution is meant to make the social contract and the government function in a healthier way, in a better way. It's not an anti-law, anti-rule of law principle. It's meant to be obviously the last resort safety valve, but also a constant measure of vigilance and the vigor and health of the political community under the rule of law.
That's a wrap. Thank you, Professor Carice and Professor Zuckert, for joining me today. To continue the conversation on Locke and Montesquieu, subscribe to our new show, the FedSoc Films Podcast, wherever you listen. You can check out our film, The Philosophers Behind the Founders, on YouTube, Facebook, or on our website, fedsoc.org. That's FEDSOC.org. Thanks for listening. As always, the Federalist Society does not take any positions on the issues discussed. That's a wrap.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.